Hey, Bruiser Buddies, this is Wrestling Nostalgia with Dave Dynasty.
Before we dive into the episode, make sure you hit subscribe on the podcast platform you're listening on. Also, follow me on X at The Dave Dynasty and subscribe on YouTube by looking up Nostalgic Dave Dynasty. You can also buy one of my shirts at ProWrestlingTees.com/TheDaveDynasty. Now, enjoy the show.
Welcome to 1 hour of the toughest, roughest wrestling you'll ever see.
That's right, Dick the Bruiser said it all.
The big question, have you got the endurance? Have you got the brains to get past the excellence of execution?
The reason why Axe and myself were put on this earth is to demolish people.
Bobby Heenan, that is a very good-looking sport coat you've got on.
Yeah, and I paid for mine. Mine isn't government issue.
Yellow, everybody. Lance Russell and Dave Brown right along ringside. By golly, we're ready to go with another big week of championship wrestling.
Greetings, wrestling fans, and welcome to Wrestling Nostalgia. I'm your host, Dave Dynasty. Thank you for joining me for yet another episode. This episode, my guest is Phil Monahan, who is on to talk about Bruiser Bedlam Wrestling and his book, Blood and Bedlam in the Glass City. I also have a re-release of an interview that I did with Dr. Jerry Graham 7 years ago, where we primarily discussed some of the nuts and bolts of Bruiser Bedlam. So I wanted to put that back out as part of this discussion today. So do remember, it was recorded 7 years ago via a phone call, so the audio quality is not quite as good as most of my interviews I do, but it is definitely worth a listen for the information and stories from the good doctor. On November 8th, I will be attending the Coastal Wrestling Federation show called Overload in Milton, Florida. So if any of you listeners are in the area, come to the show and say hi. I just recently uploaded 2 wrestling figure unboxing videos on my YouTube channel. A special thank you to Figures Toy Company and the Nerd Closet for providing the awesome figures. Go check them both out and order yourself something today. I do want to take a moment to send a special good vibe wish to the WrestleCopia guru, Ray Russell. He's been experiencing some health concerns and is waiting for some test results for more information. So everybody, keep Ray and his family in your hearts. And if you're friends with him on social media, send him some love. Or just shoot the WrestleCopia page a quick message or a post, and just let Ray know that we're all pulling for him and thinking about him and hoping that this all turns out the best. All right, so let's take a quick break. And when I come back, I will have my interview with Phil Monahan, followed by that interview from 7 years ago with Dr. Jerry Graham Jr.
Filsinger Games is a tabletop cards and dice game company that has enjoyed success for over 3 decades. Their first game was Champions of the Galaxy and was released in 1986. Champions of the Galaxy is a tabletop game that features professional wrestling over 100 years in the future. Humans, aliens, and monsters battle in the Galactic Wrestling Federation for belts. Legends of Wrestling features officially licensed wrestling cards featuring stars like Ted DiBiase, Jimmy Snuka, Harley Race, and many, many more, including game sets for independent promotions. Each match takes place in real time. The action is fast and furious, and all the things that happen in pro wrestling, like cage matches, outside interference, 3-man tag matches, they also happen in the games. You have the opportunity to run your own wrestling promotion involving either real life stars or fictional characters of the future, or you can mix and match both. Visit FilsingerGames.com for more information and to order the games today. That is Filsinger Games, FilsingerGames.com to order now. If you like horror movies, be sure to check out Dave Dynasty and Ike Isaacs on the Listen to Their Screams Horror Podcast. It is available on all podcast platforms and on social media at Listen to Screams. That is Listen, the number 2, and Screams.
And welcome back to Wrestling Nostalgia. This time I'm being joined by Phil Monahan, pro wrestler, promoter, and author of the new book, Blood and Bedlam in the Glass City. Phil, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good. How you doing?
I'm good. So tell us, were you born and raised in the Toledo area?
No. No, I was born in Morenci, Michigan. And that's about a half hour from Toledo or so.
Okay.
And I grew up watching Bruiser Bedlam.
Okay. Do you remember when you first saw it, when you first discovered it?
Well, I think it was right after WWF was on Channel 36. We were just, it's just one of those things where I only got like four channels from where I was at, like Channel 11, 12, 13, and 24, or not 12, 11, 13, 24, and 36, and they were all out of Toledo.
Yeah.
So we were very limited. So the only wrestling that I was really, that I could really watch back then was WWF and the WWA Bruiser Bedlam when that came on.
Yeah. So, well, then tell us then when this came on and you discovered the WWA, you discovered Bruiser Bedlam, what, and you started watching that, what were some of your favorite memories, your favorite wrestlers from watching Bruiser Bedlam?
Oh boy, some of my favorite. I mean, I kind of like the Polynesian Wild Man, Chris Carter, Dr. Jerry Graham, Flipso Jim, Prince Mama Muhammad was another one.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make sure when I wrote that book that I gave those guys their due, because a lot of people, when they think Bruiser Bedlam, they automatically go to Chris Carter, Jerry Graham, those guys, and there were so many other moving parts in it too. So I wanted to make sure I could spread the wealth, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, I've always discovered too, a lot of people when they think Bruiser Bedlam, right, and they hear it's the, you know, WWA, they still think Bruiser Bedlam equals Dick the Bruiser, and right. And, you know, and yes, for a while he provided commentary, but it was not a Bruiser-centric promotion anymore.
No, it really wasn't. It was Jerry Graham, you know, and Chris Carter. I think they were the main brains behind that promotion.
Yeah, yeah, and I'll talk about, well, that's a good point I want to bring up here just a little bit. But you have said that recently we lost the great Wojo, he passed. And that really kind of pushed you and led you to decide that you wanted to write this book. So tell us more about that thought and that train of thinking.
I've always had great respect for the Bruiser Bedlam, and like that was part of my inspiration of getting into wrestling. And there's a guy named Bob Smith from New York who does a podcast.
Yep,
and he had. I'd read some of the things and heard some of the things he had said about Bruiser Bedlam and how that territory, he phrased it perfectly, like it was a hidden gem in all of the territories that really didn't get its due on the media coverage, you know, through all the wrestling magazines and whatnot of the time. And I totally agreed with that, the way he put that. And that's why I wrote the greatest unknown territories of the 80s, because it could, if you put Bruiser Bedlam against all those other territories that were running back then, I think it's very competitive.
Yeah, I do too. And then it's very peculiar to me because a lot of the territories, and WWA was on that track, as things were shifting, right, and things were going more towards cable, nationalized, you could tell their quality of their product and the quality of the production was just deteriorating, and it was getting, you know, and that's the way WWA was having some of those troubles. But then, when Jerry and Sam Potek Jr. and all those guys take it to Detroit, then Toledo, form it, you know, into the Bruiser Bedlam program, it was almost, it's just like it's a 180. Suddenly, you had this TV show that was peculiar, and now Bedlam was polished. The production was there, the cuts were there, the storytelling was there, the way they edited stuff, it was very, very well done, just as a television program.
Yes. You could definitely tell if you watch the, like from when it was early 80s to 1986, it does a total turnaround on their production end.
Yeah, even though, and even though, yeah, a lot of the talent's the same. Yeah, it's just that the shift, the production, the just the, you know, the storytelling in general. Well, I mean, there wasn't a lot of storytelling in the early 80s. There wasn't a lot going on in that vein. So as you know, Wojo passes, you decide you want to do this book, and you start to dive in. Did you get to connect with everyone or most people and talk to them that you wanted to for the book and get what you wanted?
Yeah, I mean, it was fairly easy, you know, because I've had a relationship with Dr. Graham and Chris Carter. Me and Carter talk almost daily, because he's a big part of what I've got going on now in wrestling with CIW. So talking to him, Terry Sullivan, I'd shoot them some things, Gary Warnchak. But when Wojo died, at first I thought, you know, maybe I should make a documentary, because there's not a lot of guys left to tell the tale of Bruiser Bedlam.
Yeah.
You know, in that territory. I mean, really, there's not. So I thought more, and I'm like, I still may do the documentary, but I'm like, you know what, this would be better if I just put this pen to paper and put this out like for a book. And I wanted to have it done by the time we did Wojo's memorial. So I crammed all that in there in about 3.5 weeks.
Yeah. That's
my day. My days consisted of whatever I had to do working while listening to interviews. A lot of those courtesy of you, you know, with your Bruiser Bedlam history there. And some of the guys that I couldn't get a hold of that I reached out to had already done interviews for you, like Al Bracero and a couple other guys, Calypso Jim. And I did talk to him on the phone as well. But your YouTube videos, they helped out quite a bit. Because when I was listening to interviews and I was at home, I was watching the show, and you know, I'm trying to put together, you know, the big angles. And then a lot of my pictures in that book are, there's not a lot of photographic history from that time besides, you know, flyers. So I was doing a lot of screen grabs and for pictures in my book.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask next, right? Yeah, like, you know, there is video out there, and I've tried to unearth more, tried to add more, but there's not. Bedlam didn't have, you know, like you said, didn't really have any magazine coverage. There wasn't a lot even necessarily in the local newspaper, you know, maybe, you know, that the typical little graphic, you know, upcoming show, but not much in the way of anything to sink your teeth into to get stories. And like you said, picture, it's peculiar, right? There's just not a lot of pictures out there, at least high quality pictures, great, you know, good pictures. And, right. And that's what I was going to ask you. How did you kind of work around that hurdle? But yeah, I mean, screen grabs or, it kind of way to do it. There's, you know, there are a few things out there.
Yeah. I mean, Chris Carter provided me with some good pictures. Gary Warnchak provided me with some good pictures, but the rest of that, like, Prince Mama Muhammad is long gone. I think he passed away in 97, and I had no way to get a hold of anybody that might have anything from him. So, there's a lot of that. And, just trying to pause the video at the right time so I can get the right picture with the, you know.
Yeah. And like you said, a lot of those guys, you know, Prince Mama, the Polynesian Wild Man, there's several of these guys are already passed away. And then there's other guys, you know, Man Mountain Tyler, a lot of these, it's like, who are they? No one, I mean, I've tried to dig, find out more about them, tried to track down something. And it's like, there's no leads. I've even, you know, you ask people even there, like Jerry and stuff, and they're like, I don't know. I don't remember his shoot name. And right. So it's hard to track down these guys. And I know in the grand scheme of wrestling, they're just blips. But in that time period of Bruiser Bedlam, they were impactful. And I want to know more about them. But it's hard to track that down. And I'm persistent. I keep at it. And hopefully I can, you know, I can find someone. But like Man Mountain Tyler. I've been trying to find something related to him for a long time.
I believe he's passed away as well.
I do too. But I'm like, you know, I'm trying to connect because, you know, a few guys I've connected with family and be able to get a little bit with. But him, I can't get a lot of information. to even yeah. try to track down family. And but so you know, and as you're reaching out to some of these guys and pulling some things from, you know, like you said, from videos and whatever, is there something that you were maybe hoping that you could find, uncover as you were writing this that didn't work out for you, that maybe you didn't find? Did you have any bullet points or of certain stuff you were seeking out that maybe you didn't find?
Not particularly. I mean, to try to cram in all that information in that short of a time, like I asked everybody what the big angles were, you know, the people that were involved, and a lot of them they all pretty much agreed on the same ones. Mm-hmm. So the only difference was some had different recollection than others. So then I had to, you know, put it in a way where, you know, both points of view were put in. And, you know, I know there's so much more that probably could have been done, focusing on Bruce of Bedlam, but I just did the best I could for the,
yeah, little time I had. But you could dig at this for years and still not get any further. It's right. It's hard when it's this niche, this pinpoint down to this particular. But like you mentioned earlier, and you're talking about angles and you're talking about key components, right?
Right.
To me, and you apparently agree because you mentioned it, Bedlam always centered around Jerry Graham Jr. and Chris Carter.
Right.
They are, to me, the brains behind it. But also on camera, their angles, their feuds, because that was like, it's like a consistent feud that ran pretty much through the entire life of Bruiser Bedlam.
Right.
And, you know, I've talked to Jerry before, and he talked about, you know, when he had the car accident and they put him on the show for a while, they felt like they needed to do something, right? So they turned Chris Carter, and it was just crazy stuff you would have never have seen at that time happening. You know,
yeah.
Jerry Graham Jr. is a face, Chris Carter's at that time, it blew my mind. No one would have thought that.
Right. Right.
So,
those I tried to use my own personal memory on what I remembered from it and what I thought was big as a fan and a kid. And the cool thing was that the three top angles in the company were kind of what I remembered as a kid too, that really stuck out, which was the car accident and the revenge on that, and then the Spinks and Wojo.
Yep,
how that was built.
Yep.
And the Calypso Jim getting his braids
cutting his hair. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And those are right. Those are the big, and for the most part, with that, you know, we've got a lot of the key components of those still around. You know, I know Wojo's not with us. I don't know. I don't think Leon Spinks is with us, but Jerry Graham Jr. also played an integral part of that. But yeah, you know, the Graham and Carter thing was extraordinary, and I, you know, at the time it blew my mind, I hated it, whatever, but now in retrospect watching it, Chris Carter was an incredible heel.
Oh yeah.
And I would never, you know, he was awesome, but he was such a good baby face. It was so wild.
Right.
And it's just, I remember at that time, not even I couldn't fathom it. It was blowing my mind that Chris Carter was acting this way, and that it was extraordinary. And you mentioned Bob Smith. He has said that this turn, the you know, the Carter heel Graham face kind of double switch, was one of the most unbelievable things he's ever seen, and one of the biggest pops from some of the footage that he's seen that people aren't aware of. I mean, it involved Jerry's son at one point,
yeah,
and stuff. So it's, they really went full bore with this, and it was extraordinary. I mean, it went into the commentary and the wraparounds on the TV show, because Chris Carter would be out there with Terry Sullivan, and it was just, they really, really committed to it. And again, though, but even the other way around, it was still the driving force, right? I mean, how many times did we see Chris Carter and partner X feuding with Jerry Graham Jr. and Don Kent?
Right.
You know, that was, these two were, to me, were the life, and they're deserving. So they're very unheralded talents.
Yes.
Extraordinary talents. And we mentioned, right, there are several important happenings in Bedlam that really worked. And you've mentioned a few of them, right? The cutting of Calypso's hair, you know, Leon Spinks' involvement near kind of towards the end. What, you know, there's the big debut of Scott Steiner. The Wojo $10,000 fan challenge was a kind of a key thing early in Bruiser Bedlam. And it brings us back around that, you know, Jerry Jaffe, Chris Carter, anybody else that was involved, Ben, they really had their creative minds on and were really thinking story first, you know, wrestling second, so to speak. And they were really invested in making this a entertaining product.
Yes. Yep. And I think one of the things that stuck out and kind of how I kind of like to book some of my stuff to this day is it was so character driven, you know?
Yeah. Right.
Like even summoning Jason from Camp Crystal Lake.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah. You know,
I think that was kind of ahead of its time a little bit, you know? Sure.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you mentioned, right, some of the fun wrestlers, and we've talked about a couple of them, right? But there was guys like Cowboy Rex Bodie, you know, and, you know, Terry Tyler, Man Mountain Tyler, Polynesian Wild Man, Prince Mama Muhammad, Muhammad Saeed, so many others that played on those 80s characters, like we mentioned, right? These,
yeah, Igor Zatkov.
Igor Zatkov, yeah, right. And just all these characters that were you could get behind and different alliances and tag teams that made sense or whatever else. And you mentioned it, but tell us again the importance, because a lot of these people, most people would never, I mean, people may have heard of Jerry Graham Jr. They may have heard of Chris Carter, right? Most of them know Scott Rexlander. More people know Great Wojo, things like that. A lot of these guys, especially your general wrestling fan, have no idea who they are, who we're talking about.
Right.
And you mentioned that it was very important to you to mention these guys, talk some about them, bring a little light, because they were very key in this time period. That seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, seems to be it was a goal of you from the get-go is to bring shine some light on these guys.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Because I think for an 80s wrestling fan, every major promotion in the 80s had what Bruiser Bedlam had. They had the Russian heel. Every territory had one.
Yep.
They had the big African monster, which every territory... You know, Kamala was out there, Prince Mama Muhammad. You know, they had that. They had the Cowboys.
Yeah.
Everybody had a cowboy. Mm-hmm. Jerry Graham made Rex Bodie a cowboy. just like, you know, and the Jason thing, the monster from you know, the movie.
Yeah.
So many. That was a it was like. 80s wrestling, if you had to put a definition, you could just lay that all out right there because it was everything. And I think they were, you know, right around that time, they started doing the backstage stuff too. Graham getting attacked in his office and different places. And I remember the first time seeing like Dusty Rhodes get jumped in a parking lot by the Horsemen. That was, you know, I compare it to that, you know, the cutting edge stuff right there.
Yeah.
And I think... You know, that played a part that made them stick out from just, you know, the Sheik's territory and anybody else.
Yeah, and it's hard, I guess, to express to a modern wrestling fan that maybe, you know, wasn't old enough to see some of this. Because a lot of what Bedlam was doing was very much the same thing that, you know, WWF, WWE was doing, just on the local scale. But... it was a lot of people look at some of this stuff and they laugh at, oh, it's copycat. It's not really. No,
not really.
The thing is, and I've heard it so, especially with Memphis, so many people talk about it and say it. It's like your local sports team. You're watching. This is your area's wrestling product. And this is so, you know, these are the guys you're getting behind because they're from your neck of the woods.
Right.
So it's very much like a local sports team that you're getting behind. And these are the guys you can go to your local high school gym or your local armory or your local whatever event center, whatever it might be, and see them.
Yes.
And it's different. We're very invested at that time. We're in, you know, I you know, don't get me wrong. I loved WWF at the time. I loved NWA at the time. I loved anything I could watch. I watched everything that I could get my hands on. But I felt different about WWA because I just felt like I was from Indiana, right? I was born and raised in Indiana. I felt like this was Midwest. This was ours.
Yeah.
And it was so I just felt, and I was very defensive of it.
It was gritty, and it was, I think if I had to compare it to something, I would give the WWA like a mix of a lot of Memphis. I would compare it to a lot of Memphis wrestling if I had to compare it to any kind of other territory out there. So I think if you liked Memphis wrestling, you would love watching the WWA Bedlam.
And again, I mean, like you mentioned, right, Bob Smith talking about when he got to watch it that he hadn't really seen, and thinking, whoa, where was this at? Why did I not see this? And how good it was. I mean, I think a lot of people, they just give it a chance. It's very entertaining. I will forever, and I don't know if he needs any more ego stroke, but I will forever say Jerry Jaffe's one of the greatest talents ever in professional wrestling. He is such a smart guy, such a witty talker. And then again, same with Chris Carter. I think these are two guys that not enough people know.
No, absolutely. They're
And
they have great minds for the business.
yeah,
Yeah.
it's I don't know. I just wish a lot of people, again, like you mentioned, there's a lot of stuff out there on my YouTube channel. I help people. Then these are straight transfers off of TV tape, so they're pretty good quality. So hopefully a lot of people will check those out. And I hope people will also, get Phil's book, and read a little more about it, get a little more information. It's kind of that perfect guidebook if you're going to watch some of this to read as you follow along. But let's shift away a little bit. I think people should also check out Championship International Wrestling, because I
Absolutely.
really think you have, and I think purposely, have a very Bruiser Bedlam flavor,
Oh, absolutely.
and that you've very intentionally always paid tribute to Bedlam, from your color scheme to the choices of your songs. There's a lot of that. That's even the format of some of the opening of your TV show, your web shows and stuff. Very, very much a tribute, a nod, an homage to Bruiser Bedlam. What if someone,
Absolutely.
maybe if someone's not in the Toledo area or in the Midwest, tell someone how there's still opportunity for them to be able to check out some CIW stuff. What's the best way for them to do that?
YouTube, our channel is CIW Pro Wrestling on YouTube, and our show CIW Ringside's on there. We've been on a little hiatus, because we didn't run quite as much in the summer, but we've got a new home at the Belief Center in Toledo, Ohio, on 1 Aurora Gonzalez Avenue, right off Anthony Wayne Trail. We just had Toledo's first women's steel cage match last
Oh,
Sunday.
all right.
So
Very nice.
yeah, and you can, sometimes you stop in, you'll always see Chris Carter there.
Yeah.
Sometimes you'll see Terry Sullivan there. He was one of our announcers until he retired.
Yep.
And even once in a while, Dr. Graham.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, I mean, being right there until you never know, right? You never know who will stop by. But if you go, Phil will be there, is
Yeah.
in the present. Chris Carter will be there. So buy the book, go to a CIW show if you can get there, have Phil sign it, have Chris Carter sign it, anybody else that might be there, and everything else. It's but if you can't get there, then hey, that's okay, right? Watch it on YouTube, support it that
Watching
way.
them. Yep.
Because again, not only does it have a flavor, not only is it an homage, but like you mentioned, you'll see some of that talent there. Chris Carter doing a lot of commentary and things for you. To me,
Yes.
a stroke of genius. It's a brilliant move. He's perfect in that role. So, you got the book, right? You're running CIW. You did mention the documentary. What's next for Phil Monahan?
Oh boy. I got so many irons in the fire. I'm trying to get this movie made that I've got a script for and have been working on it the last couple years, last few years, I'd say at least 4 or 5 years. We're starting to get some steam. I got some investors on it. It's a movie about Elvis Presley.
Oh, cool.
He faked his death to hunt Bigfoot.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, and there's a reporter that's trying to track down the story, and there's some hillbillies that want to get their hands on the same footage. So it's when I get this thing out, that'll be my bucket list will be done. So
That sounds fun. Yeah, there you go. So Phil's got a lot of stuff going on. Check him out. Phil's, go back to the archives. Phil's been on the show a couple different times. talking about different things, you know, topics we've had. But again, the book, once again, is Blood and Bedlam in the Glass City. You can get it on Amazon. Very easy, you know, to order. Go get a copy. Check it out. I highly suggest it. I've got my copy. Bill, you also have another book out there, right? That's on Amazon as well.
I've got two other books out there.
Okay.
The one is my autobiography. My battle with COVID, and it pretty much took me out of the ring for the most part. So I'm lucky to be alive. And then I wrote my first science fiction book.
All right.
And it's called The Ripple Effect, about a physicist who makes a little timepiece to go back in time. His sister was killed in a protest, and he makes a little timepiece, a little watch, and he goes back in time and decides to save Abraham Lincoln, thinking that that will progress civil rights into a better direction. And in real life, it just reignited the Civil War, and slavery was still around in 2045. And he has to, when he gets back to his own time, he has to go back in time again to try to fix it. And yeah, it's,
there you go.
Yeah, it's a heck of a book.
There you go. So, yeah, just go again. I think you can just go to Amazon, look at Phil Monahan. You'll probably find all three.
All three. Yeah.
All three. So, you know, go order them all. But if you're wrestling centric, right, definitely buy the autobiography. But also, I can't recommend Blood and Bedlam enough. Obviously, like Phil, I'm a huge proponent of Bruiser Bedlam. So go check it out.
I got the approval of Chris Carter, Jerry Graham, and Terry Sullivan on the book.
There you go.
All three of them thought it was great. And so, as long as those three are happy, you know, I'm good.
My job is done. That's right. So go buy the book. Check out CIW on YouTube. Check out a show if you're in the area. But check out some of Phil's other work and stuff he's doing. Go in the archives, listen to some of our other chats that we've had. Phil, I'm sure in the future you'll probably be back on the show for something else. as a fellow WWA, as a fellow Bruiser Battle fan, I'm sure we'll chat again in the future. But I wanted to come on. I'll take any opportunity to talk Bruiser Bedlam, but I really wanted to come on and talk about your book, and hope that maybe if there's anybody not aware of it, I'm hoping we open their eyes and they'll go get a copy, because I can't recommend it enough. So Phil, thank you for giving me some time talking about the book. Thank you for helping keep the memory of Bruiser Bedlam alive. Thank you for what you're doing out there promoting.
Absolutely.
And everything else. And keep up the good fight. And let's keep the memory of these guys alive and keep fighting to preserve that history. So if people want to follow you, Phil, and know, again, you said you got a lot of stuff you're working on and hoping to do, what's the best way for them to follow you so they can keep track of these upcoming projects?
I'm Phil Monahan on Facebook, Championship International Wrestling on Facebook. I'm also on Instagram too, Phil Monahan.
Okay. There you go. So go give him a follow. That way, when these things develop, you can be right there and know all the information. So, Phil, again, thank you for your time. Thank you for joining me. And I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Thank you.
Hey ho, everybody. Subscribe to the Pinhead Pod, the Ramones fan podcast, bringing you interviews, news, deep dives, and much more. Look it up on your favorite podcast platform. That is Pinhead Pod.
He is a multi-time WWA Tag Team Champion, the former owner of Bruiser Bedlam Wrestling, and the most educated man in professional wrestling. He is Dr. Jerry Graham Jr. Doctor, how are you tonight?
Very good, but that's the most highly educated. Don't forget to put in highly educated.
Highly. I apologize.
Other than that, that's all right. If I answer your question, I'm fine. I'm glad to be with you tonight, Dave.
All right. And this episode, Doctor, we are going to talk about kind of some behind the scenes of Bruiser Bedlam, how it came to be, and its history. Are you ready to dive in?
I'm ready. You ask the questions, and I'll answer them.
All right. Well, let's start. Let's kind of give a little back history leading to Bruiser Bedlam. You'd been working for Bruiser in Indianapolis for several years, and main evented, become a big draw and star for Bruiser. So how did it get to the point where you and Bruiser were talking and discussing becoming partners? How did it get to there?
Well, I was always a businessman at heart, and I could see the real money in professional wrestling is in promotion. That's a no-brainer.
Right.
So I didn't want to get into promotion, but I didn't want to start any outlaw promotions and make a bunch of enemies. But I went, but Toledo had gone dead. The Sheik had been there, but he hadn't been running there, so it was just nothing there. So Bruiser had told me that if I could get Toledo Television, would be partners in Toledo and in any other towns that I might be able to get for him. So I was able to get the Toledo Television, Fox Channel 36 with Miller Beer as a sponsor, which a lot of times we didn't have sponsors, which meant that Miller Beer paid for the TV time. So I started Dick out with a pretty sweet deal.
Right.
Because a lot of time in those days, wrestling promotions had to actually pay for the time on TV and hopefully sold enough tickets to take care of everything. But in this particular case, and Miller Beer also paid for half of our production.
Right.
Well, we got into there, but then we were approached by a Pass Sports Network in Detroit. They approached me, and they had this idea that they wanted to do a wrestling show with Victor Bruiser as the commentator. Mm-hmm. So I got all the people together. I got Bruiser, and I got the guys from Pass. I can't recall the names right now. It's been so long. But so we went on Pass Sports. Now, I don't know if Pass is still in business anymore. Do you know that? I mean, it was one of those sports channels in the 80s.
Yeah, I don't know.
But anyway, we got on Pass, and then Pass started doing our production for us. And the deal was that we would get a copy of the tape, so we didn't need Miller Beer to help us with production, because Pass was doing the production, and that was part of our deal, that we would get a copy of the tape used in our other towns.
Yeah.
Well, we went into the Premier Center, which was outside of Detroit. It was a beautiful facility. We did very well, but I'm not going to – one thing I did tell you I'd answer any question, but this could be – be legal, you know what I mean? Let's just say that some of the intermediary Pass was fine, okay? Mm-hmm. But some of the intermediaries that we were dealing with to help put the deal together were not so fine.
Yeah.
And things weren't being distributed the way they should be being distributed. We caught it. So we just kept the name Bruiser Bedlam, and we got back with Miller Beer, Sam Botek, very generous, good fan. And we moved our promotion to the Hotel Sofitel in Toledo.
Right.
But pretty much that's what it was. It went from WWA to the Bruiser Bedlam, Dick the Bruiser, Terry Sullivan as the commentators. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Dick the Bruiser had so much confidence in me, he put me in charge of booking the whole promotion. Because at that time we had Detroit, we had Ann Arbor, through George Cannon, we had Windsor, Ontario.
So when you and Bruiser started this partnership, was he the only owner of WWA at the time?
Well, he and Wilbur Snyder were partners, but Wilbur Snyder had retired.
Okay.
So I'm not sure what their exact financial agreement was, whether Wilbur would get so much money or whatever. I have no idea.
Okay.
I know Wilbur was out of the picture. He retired to Florida.
Okay.
And Dick stayed on. And Dick had me helping him in Indiana as well, though I didn't have a piece of Indiana. Indiana and Illinois, I was an employee, but in Ohio and Michigan, I was a partner.
Okay.
And our headquarters were in Toledo, and we did very well.
Yeah.
And we did very well with that promotion.
And you mentioned Sam Botek. So he was the Miller distributor, right, that helped with you? Several programs. I mean, I remember seeing him on a few programs.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
He was very into wrestling. And he knew his wrestling. He knew the bit. He would do some color commentary. He would do some interviews. Once he even got into a six-man tag match, and he did very well.
Yeah.
Of course, after the match is over, he's laying flat on his back in a dressing room, gasping for air. But I'm telling you, he did a good job for having never wrestled before. And he liked to be part of the promotion, and he was very generous with his sponsorship, and he was a very nice man. He was a big contributor to charities such as Make-A-Wish Foundation and stuff. And he has since sold his distributorship and retired to Florida. But
right.
I have nothing but the finest things to say about Sam Botek, because without him, Bruiser Bedlam couldn't have continued after we left Pass.
Yeah. Okay. And that, well, another name I came across, and I'm not sure what the title was, John Robinson Block, I believe, was a newspaper editor,
yes,
and publisher. What role
Absolutely.
Did he play?
Absolutely. Well, he played a very big role because they also owned the cable system.
Okay.
And they also owned five TV stations. At that time, I don't know what they have now. I haven't seen John in years. He and I at one time were very good friends, but he owned the Toledo Blade and the Buckeye cable system. Uh-huh. And then he bought a newspaper in Pittsburgh. He lives in Pittsburgh now. And they own a TV station. The last I heard in Louisville, Lafayette, Indiana, all over the country. Very, very successful. He got us on their cable channel I first took Bruiser's tapes before Bruiser Bedlam. They had a cable channel for Toledo, and he got us on, charged us nothing, and he gave us good newspaper coverage, too. Those days, people still read the paper, though it's getting more and more to the Internet today. But he was another one. I always said there were three people that wasn't for outside of myself making me four, but three people that made Bruiser Bedlam possible was Sam Botek, John Robinson Block, and a man named Dennis Cattell. He was the station manager at Channel 36, and he also helped me a lot with the production.
Okay.
He showed me how to produce, how to work the equipment, and he helped us put the show together, and he was a tremendous, tremendous help to us, and it was a collaboration. I try to tell the young guys of today that they want to do everything. Uh-huh. Get involved with an organization.
Yeah.
Have a collaboration, but 90% of them just don't understand. They don't grasp how this business should be structured.
Yeah.
You know, but that's a story for another day.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
A subject for another day.
Yeah. And as you mentioned earlier, your lead commentator was Terry Sullivan. How far back do you and Terry go in the business?
No, back to the early 70s. He was around when I started in the business. I think he might have started a little before me. But I saw him just the other day, and we're still friends. We still keep in touch. And he was very, very brilliant. He had a great vocabulary, a good speaking voice, yeah. And he knew wrestling.
Yeah.
He knew what was going on. He could pick up on things. He was very good.
Now, did he call wrestling for Sheik or anything prior to Bedlam? Or?
Well, he started with the Sheik.
Yeah, okay.
He started as a ring announcer, then they made him a commentator. As far as I was concerned, of all the commentators the Sheik had, I always thought Terry Sullivan was the best.
Yeah.
But that's an opinion.
Yeah.
But, of course, I'm an expert on wrestling, so my opinion is very valuable.
Yeah. I always loved the stuff in Bedlam with you and Terry interacting. I thought, because you guys were such great contrast to each other in the interaction, I thought it was so great with some of your interactions on Graham's Gallery and different clips. I thought you guys worked really well together.
Well, it's because he and I both have the head for the business. We know what to do.
Yes.
And that was, I wasn't just born that way, and neither was Terry. Some people have a proclivity to be a good carpenter, a good plumber, I could do different things. We had a mind for wrestling, and we listened and paid attention to the older guys that would show us stuff that we would absorb. Right. Terry could absorb stuff, and I could absorb stuff. And that was it was what we were meant to do, I guess.
Yeah. So how did the name Bruiser Bedlam come about?
That was amazing. I could sit here and bloviate and say that was my idea because I'm a genius, but it was Cass's idea.
Okay.
They gave it the name. Yeah.
Okay.
So we had a friendly part of the ways after they realized the middlemen had not been doing what they're supposed to do, there was no problem with us keeping the name.
Yeah. So Bruiser Bedlam was it a separate entity of Championship Wrestling and WWA?
Well, because we moved those tapes right into Indiana and Illinois too. Started running on all the tapes. And in fact, Bruiser and I had a deal, which I thought was kind of unique in this business. After we got established, I had my towns, I had Detroit, I had with partnership. Now, when I say I mean Dick and I.
Yeah.
I had Detroit, but then when we got to a point, Dick says, "Here's the deal." He says, "Anything you get is yours, and anything I get is mine." So if I'd have gone and got Cleveland would have been all mine.
Uh-huh.
If he would have went and got Louisville with these tapes, it would have been all his.
Yeah.
This is when we were doing the tapes in Toledo. We were going 50-50 on the production. So we had towns that we were partners in and splitting up, and then Dick came up with that deal. So a lot of times guys would come up to me and say, "I hope you're not mad because I bought some Bruiser Bedlam tapes from Dick." And I said, "Why should I be mad? That's a deal. If he wanted to make copies and sell them, he could. If I wanted to make copies, I mean, it was just that it was his idea. It worked out fine for me because I started running a few towns. It was all mine. And once again, the money in wrestling is in the unless you happen to be like a real big Superman, like old Steve Austin or something. But for the average wrestler, if you want to make money, you got to be in the. You got to have a piece of the action.
Right." So was Dick still running many shows in Indiana? I mean, or was it just sporadic at this point?
Yeah.
Yeah?
No, he was running South Bend, Indianapolis at the Tyndale Armory. I'm trying to think, Fort Wayne. I forget the name. We were in the big Coliseum, but he moved to a smaller building in Fort Wayne.
Uh-huh.
Hammond, Indiana, we seem to stay at the Hammond Civic Center. And then he always had, some fundraisers with booster clubs and stuff for schools and that. And those are usually successful.
Yeah.
So see what like schools, we can't get the booster clubs nowadays to see, but what they would do is if they would have like one show a year. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about running wrestling on a regular basis, like think of Jonesville, Indiana or something. I just make that name up. But if it was going to be a once-a-year thing, they would usually have the place packed. Mm-hmm. I ran a town here in Toledo, in the Ohio area, called Continental Ohio, and we did $10,000 in sales. That was my best spot show ever. And a few months later, they wanted to try it again, and it dropped to $6,000. But $6,000 was still good. So there could be a lot of money to be raised. And when Dick the Bruiser in his prime, man, he had like a couple of schools a week, 52 weeks a year at fair dates in the summer to fill in with the towns. That makes a lot of extra money for a promotion.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so essentially, so you were running Ohio, Michigan. He was running Indiana, Illinois. And you were running the same tapes that you were recording out of Toledo. And you were taking them to your towns and your areas. He was taking them to his. And it was just a split. Yeah. Your business is yours. His is his. But yet you were working together in a cooperation.
The first towns I got, our partnership didn't dissolve. We were still partners in Detroit. We were still partners in Toledo. We were still partners in the cities that we started.
Uh-huh.
But then after that got established, and that was being most people didn't think he was generous, but of course he was thinking of himself too. So if he figured if he got a big town, I might come in and say, "Hey, wait a minute, we got that town." I could see where he was protecting himself as well. But it was like I said, if I got Cleveland or Columbus or anything like that, that would have been mine.
Yeah,
so, I did get a few smaller towns, but that was the deal. It was still very fair. And I did very well. One thing I'd like to say about Bruiser Bedlam right now, if I may, just to go on the record, is I have no life anymore, so I spend a lot of time on the internet.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and every now and then I come upon a chat room or something like that where I talk about how the dying days of Bruiser Bedlam and how we went bankrupt.
Yeah.
Just for the record, Bruiser Bedlam turned a profit every year.
Yeah.
Our last year was exceptionally good because we had that Leon Spinks deal where Wojo fought Leon Spinks in a mixed match, and that drew a lot of money. And we did very well, but Dick and I were both what I would say visionaries.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by that is some guys will fall off the Empire State Building, and they'll get to the 50th floor, they'll say, "It doesn't hurt yet." But a wise man knows that 50 more floors is going to hurt a lot. So at that time, Dick said we could compete against WWF at the time they were called, because they only would come to town like once every couple of months. So we would run like every couple of weeks. But when then Ted Turner got into it, we could see that it would be probably seven or eight shows in our towns, run in our big towns, run by them that would kill our action. So we decided it'd be a good idea to close down while we were ahead.
Yeah.
And we did. And we shook hands, and Dick and I were friends to the day he died.
Yeah.
But sometimes, you know, a good poker player knows when to fold his hand.
Mm-hmm.
But we never went bankrupt. We never went broke. Nobody ever didn't get paid that worked for us. In fact, the guys that worked for us for the size promotion we were, the guys that are still alive, said we paid very well, which we did.
Yeah.
Because we're used to making $50 for a main event, we're getting $250 for a main event.
Yeah,
I mean, it was just, I think it was a successful promotion, but a lot of times people get jealous, and it's always the curs and mongrels that snip away at the tails of champions.
Yep, that's right. So now, I heard you tell a story one time about talking about when you were running in downtown Toledo at the hotel, and you helped kind of revitalize the downtown there, but then there ended up having some issues with the kind of the community's vision, and wrestling and boxing wasn't fitting in that. What was that all about?
Well, that was, have you ever read the book, The Peter Principle? Shows how incompetent people get promoted because the guy promoting them doesn't want to promote anybody that might take their job. In other words, you're a manager somewhere, you're not going to hire an assistant that you might think is smarter than you. So the book's about how the whole corporate world works on promotions being based on how the guy hiring you, it's going to affect. He doesn't want to hire somebody who can take his job. Well, we had a bunch of imbeciles like that running Toledo.
Okay.
Now, they wanted to build up downtown Toledo. Now, we had this beautiful facility. It's still there, but it's been run down a little bit. But it was a top-notch French hotel called the Hotel Sofitel.
Mm-hmm.
beautiful ballroom. It was Sam Botek's idea for Miller Beer to run in there, and John Black was all for it. He gave us great publicity. And we would go in there the first Sunday of every month and have the place packed. And we were going out on all of our syndicated. We were being seen in Springfield, Illinois, which led into St. Louis. We were being seen in Chicago, Indianapolis, Detroit, Windsor, also Ontario because of George Cannon's connections. Mm-hmm. And we were just starting to get letters and stuff from people that wanted to know what our schedule was because they wanted to come to Toledo and stay because downtown Toledo was dead at the time. Mm-hmm. They wanted to stay at the Hotel Sofitel for the weekend, take in the matches on Sunday, you know, and just spend some time in Toledo. Mm-hmm. So we were doing well. So a boxing promoter got the same idea. He put on a terrific show in Toledo at the Sofitel. I was there. And they had 10 former or current world champions at ringside, including Tommy Hearns, to sign autographs. And we had a light heavyweight champion from Toledo named Bernard Benton at the time. He fought a non-title fight. So it was a first-class boxing show. Place was being packed. And what I'm saying, this in itself was not going to save downtown Toledo. It was like the building blocks. Mm-hmm. But here you are. You got boxing and wrestling going out all over the Midwest. In fact, boxing was on the PASS Sports Network at that time, which was going out even farther. And people were starting to talk about Toledo. And we were getting fan mail from Toledo, and we were getting this, we were getting that. And then one day, the Hotel Sofitel was connected to the Owens, Illinois building. It was a huge corporation that has a world headquarters in Toledo, the glass company.
Okay.
They had an executive, and they to help Sofitel out, they booked like 25 rooms every night, whether they used them or not, just to have, because they may have somebody come in at the last minute, they need to have a room. So it was a Sunday night, and a guy came into Toledo for a Monday meeting from Owens, Illinois. So he's walking around, he walks over because they were connected buildings, and he sees there's some wrestling going on in the Sofitel, so he thinks it's going to be collegiate wrestling. He thought it was going to be Olympics, it's going to be AAU, and at the time he walked in, it was the middle of a barbed wire match. Everybody's bleeding, and Scott Steiner, who I started, was in the match, and he put up such a fuss and such a complaint, even though we were bringing in the Sofitel's occupancy was about 6 to 8 rooms on a Sunday night, and every Sunday we were packed. They would always run out of beer in the bars because the guys would come in, eat early, then drink after the matches. It was bringing commerce to downtown Toledo.
Right.
But and I got that idea, Sam Botek picked us up from the Chase Hotel in St. Louis, which had wrestling since the 40s. And that was a real 5-star hotel. That made the Sofitel look like a Red Wolf Inn. Well, I mean, the big cities like St. Louis had the sophistication. They could do that. But in Toledo, these guys are just small-minded people with no vision, and that's why Toledo's in a very bad shape right now.
Yeah,
it's just it should be, you know, we're on the Great Lakes or the Midwest. We're on all these highways and turnpikes. We should be a boom town.
Yeah,
but that was the thinking. Now, they didn't understand. They threw us out of the Sofitel. They threw the boxing out of the Sofitel. They replaced it with dinner theater.
Yeah.
Now the 20 people that were there, disappointed because the show closed after the first act.
Wow.
That's a joke, you see. Yeah.
So
the show closes. Most shows do finish the first night anyway.
Yeah.
It was a total disaster. It was a total disaster, the dinner theater. And it was done. It was just amazing because I could see it. I should have ran for mayor, I suppose. But I'm too honest. So I wouldn't have made a good politician.
Yeah. So you said you ran the hotel once a month. Is that what you said?
First Sunday of every month.
And were you recording TV then? Is that?
Yeah, we did our TV at the Sofitel. We did the TV at the Sofitel, yes. We recorded. Okay. That's right. What was I going to say? I forget now, but something reminded me when I said we were first Sunday of every month, ran the Sofitel. And I had a thought, but it's happens to get to be 70 and senile.
So, yeah. Okay. So you, the first Sunday of every month, and you recorded a month's worth of TV, correct? When did you, go ahead.
Well, what we would do is we would just record the shows. Okay.
Okay.
And then we'd also have a free taping session in the studios at Channel 11, even though we were running at Channel 36, 11 let us do, you know, studio matches where you have three or four rows of people.
Yeah.
So we'd take the studio matches and the hotel matches, and we'd later post-produce the shows with wraparounds where Terry Sullivan and the guest would talk about that the show, and they would move the storyline along. Very good at it.
Okay.
Very good at it. It takes really two people to do that, and they did a very good job, and it was just a complete success. After we lost the Sofitel, things went downhill. Also, we're still making money, but at Sofitel, for a brief period of time, I had the record for money paid for tickets for a wrestling match in Toledo. Now, not head count, because the record holder was the old Nature Boy Buddy Rogers, who had like 6,000 people come to the Toledo Sports Arena, but they only getting a buck a ticket in those days.
Yeah, right.
So I'm talking about in the 50s. So anyway, the night that I came out, I recovered from my car accident and wrestled Chris Carter. We did $15,000, which had never been done at the sports arena. Of course, a few months later, Hulk Hogan came in and did $95,000. So it was a short-lived record, but at one time I had the record for the most money paid for. And that night, by the way, I wrestled Carter. This is a true story. The fire marshal cut the crowd off.
Uh-huh.
So that's a true sellout. A sellout is a very overused word. They say, well, hey, we sold out. Maybe it was 90% full. It might have been a huge crowd. They say it was sold out.
Yeah.
You're not sold out until the fire marshal cuts off the crowd, as far as I'm concerned.
That's right. Okay. Where did you record those wraparounds and, like, your Graham's Gallery clips and things like that? Was that done at the TV studios or?
Well, Graham's Gallery we started doing in Detroit, and we kept doing them in the studios at Channel 36.
Okay.
And the wraparounds were done at the Channel 36 production studios as well.
Yeah.
All sponsored by Miller Beer.
Did you ever have any backlash from the Sheik once you started getting successful in Toledo?
Of course. He tried to get Channel 36 away from me. He wasn't running Toledo, and he had fired me. Let's keep this in mind right now. I think we talked about that in our last show.
Yeah.
Very briefly, just as I was working with the Sheik, I was one of his most loyal employees. I would have done anything for that man because he helped me get started in wrestling.
Yep.
And then I told you in the last show, but just to catch up, I was riding with Big Jerry Graham. This is before I took his name and became his son. We were just working, and we had the Indianapolis on our route. So we were in Indianapolis one day, and the Sheik was there, and the Sheik and Jerry Graham got in a horrible argument about something that had happened in Toronto. At that point, I had never even wrestled in Toronto. I was not partners with Jerry Graham. I was just another wrestler in the dressing room. But because I was with Jerry Graham, the Sheik fired me as well. And I called and asked what's going on, and he wouldn't use me, and that was it. So guess what? Then they closed Toledo down. I didn't feel I had hurt or double-crossed anyone. But he sure tried to get back in to Toledo once I got it. And so I don't know. Obviously, he didn't like the idea of me being there, but it's not like I went in there and ran simultaneously against him or anything.
Yeah.
Toledo was a dead town when I took it over.
Yeah.
Nothing was going on.
Did he ever try to run opposition to you? Did he ever try to run a show when you were running or anything like that?
Not that I recall.
No, he just tried to...
They had shows in his little building to hold 100 people and stuff. I know I had some competition. Well, I can't honestly say I remember the Sheik running up. I don't want to say something I don't know is positive.
Yeah.
I don't recall. I know we had a lot of position here and there, but they don't last long. Because without TV, you've got nothing.
Yeah.
I don't care
how
good your matches are. That's why we're back on TV here in Toledo. And you can watch the show anywhere in the world on Fight TV if you get the app. F-I-T-E.
Uh-huh.
It's free.
Uh-huh.
And you can watch Powerbomb Wrestling whenever you want to just mention that in passing.
And I have a note that in like 1989, you moved to Channel 24 WNWO. Is that correct?
This is a great story if you want to hear it. This is a good one.
Yeah.
Okay. This is why WWE put Ted Turner out of business. You can multiply this story by 100.
Okay.
When Dick the Bruiser and I parted ways as friends, the Turner people approached me to run Toledo for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I immediately had Miller Beer sponsor their show on Channel 24. So think about this. They got Channel 24 for nothing. Right. Now, they went into Channel 36 Fox, so I was also friends, but they bought time there. Uh-huh. Okay, so they were on two times. Now, McMahon came in and got on Channel 36 as well. So I had two shows on, and I had said I wanted I wanted 10% of the gate, and they had mentioned to me as well, Harley Race only gets 7.5% of the gate in St. Louis, and I says, has he got your free television? And he says, no. Okay, so anyway, I have never seen a more incompetent mishmash of managers. We'll talk about the wrestlers. The WCW wrestlers were great. Many of them are still my friends to this day. But they told me, here's the schedule. It's going to be, we're going to run a show every second month. We're going to run 8 weeks. There'll be 4 weeks with generic interviews, just about nothing. Then there'll be 4 weeks about we're coming to Toledo. The first show, they went 7 weeks without one mention of Toledo. On the eighth week, they finally, with 1 week's thing, we did $16,000. And they just kept forgetting to run the ads. They kept forgetting to run them. They just didn't run them. Now, but on top of that, Channel 36 called me and says, we don't want one, two wrestling shows. We only want one wrestling show. Since you're from Toledo and you're with Turner, Toledo will talk to us. I'm sure they wanted a little bit more money, but they were going to kick McMahon and WWF at the time off the air. I would have had exclusive. Not one person from Atlanta would call me back. Not one person. This is when Jim Herd was running things. I tried to call Jim Barnett. He wouldn't talk to me. I tried to call everybody. I told this girl, Jordan, who's a very nice lady, used to answer the phone. I said, we can have all of Toledo. I told her what happened. Then when they decided to kick Turner off and give it to Vince, I got called and said, how could I let this possibly happen? How could you let this happen? I was a nervous wreck because I was this close to getting McMahon out of Toledo, and these guys down at Turner were too stupid to pick up a call. I told Terry Funk about that. He just rolled his eyes. He said, well, if I'd have been the booker down there, that had been out, it'd have been out real quick, Jerry, because when I book in territory, I pay attention to the promoters in each town.
Yeah.
Because every town has its own kind of a personality. What works in Toledo may not work in Columbus and so forth, and Terry understood that. That's why I never could understand why they didn't make him the booker. Ole Anderson was a very poor booker at best.
Yep.
Terry Funk is a genius.
Yep.
And I think that Vince McMahon had a horrible night sleeping if Terry Funk had taken over the book at WCW. But now, you see how badly they screwed up Toledo. I heard other horror stories in other cities about their total incompetency, because I'll tell you what they didn't do. What they should have done is, I heard they had little cliques. This is what I heard from guys who work there. Mm-hmm. Like Hulk Hogan, his clique of guys. Kevin Sullivan had his clique of guys. And they were competing against each other. And somebody else, I guess Nash and Hall, they had their little clique.
Yes.
And when you run a wrestling promotion, I'm telling you right now, anybody out there that's thinking about getting in business, which is not really a good idea because wrestling's not too healthy this time, but one person runs that promotion as far as the booking and the matches go. And that man is Hitler. That man is Mussolini. That man is Caesar. If he's not doing a good job, then the owner should fire him. When you start having groups of guys competing with each other about what you're going to do, you're done.
Yeah.
You're beat. It's like going a 100-yard dash with 50-pound weights on your legs. They were falling off the Empire State Building deal. With Ted Turner's money, I don't know who's advising them, but WCW could have been still in business to this day, but the people running it, it was just an absolute horrible. And McMahon, as much as I've talked about him in the past, was very efficient. He was the dictator, and he is, that we need to have a successful promotion. It's okay to have lieutenants that you can give orders to, and advisors that make suggestions to you. I'm not saying you have to do everything yourself. We have a very small promotion theater right now. We have a booker's meeting once a month, and I'm in charge of everything, not to brag, but because I'm more experienced than they are. But they give me suggestions. So they say, that stinks. Mm-hmm. And other ones say, hey, that's not a bad idea. So I mean, I don't do it all on my own, but that's how you've got to do it. There's got to be one guy. Before I made my deal with Bruiser, Bruiser was it. Wilbur Snyder was a partner, but they would have a meeting with Wilbur Snyder and I guess Bobby Heenan and Sam Benneker. And they would sit down and talk about what they were going to do. And that's the only way to do it. Dick DeBruiser was our dictator there, and he was very successful.
Yep. Yeah.
You go to an independent. How many independent shows have you gone to in your lifetime, Dave?
Oh, I couldn't even tell you. Countless.
When you walk in, you see a bunch of guys all talking about what their matches are going to be like by themselves separately. You walk in the dressing room.
Yeah.
When you see that, they're done.
Yeah.
When you see that, they're done.
Yeah.
There's somebody tell them, at our matches at Powerbomb Wrestling, everything is totally organized. Whether we succeed or fail, we're doing things correctly. And right now, things are getting better. And I'd like to just put in one little plug, if I may.
Yeah.
Now this is not going to make me a dime because it's something that's already happened.
Uh-huh.
But I want to just mention it. On our last show on Powerbomb Championship Wrestling, which is St. Clements Hall in Toledo, Ohio, you can check the Powerbomb's schedule, Facebook page, or PowerbombExcitement.com or whatever. Was the greatest match I have ever seen in my entire 40 years in wrestling. It was a cage match. Mm-hmm. It was four guys. One of them called History in the Making. The other's called CIA. They got in a 16-foot steel cage. And I'm not just talking about the best cage match I've ever seen. I go back to Buddy Rogers, who I thought was the greatest wrestler of all time and still do. But in this match, there was so much activity. I'm talking about suplexes off the top of the 16-foot cage into the middle of the ring.
Yeah.
I'm talking about psychology that went with it. I'm talking about everything you can imagine. It was at this point, the old timers always talk about how good things were in the old days, and they were good. I got to admit, but these guys, I got it. These guys are a throwback. These kids had this back on kids because they're in their 20s and I'm 70. I got grandkids in their 20s right now.
Yeah.
But these kids, it was the greatest match I've ever seen.
Wow.
And they're not going to show it on television because they keep the key matches off of TV.
Yeah.
But I am telling you, I have never seen anything as great as that match.
Yeah.
History in the Making is a young team. Celeste Taylor, I can't even think of his partner's name. Then the CIA, you got Denzel Titan and I forget the other guy's name too, but they're all terrific, terrific young wrestlers. And I'll tell you, that's what this game is all about, young minds and young legs.
Yep.
Once you get to be 40, you can't do it like you used to. You get guys like we're doing, getting experienced guys in their 20s and early 30s, and you're going to have some real action.
Yep, that's right.
I just mentioned that.
Yeah. So one question that I've gotten asked several times is, why was Dr. Jerry Graham Jr. never WWE champion? Why was that never the trigger never pulled?
Well, because that's a good question. That's a very good question. And when I was booking the whole territory, I was booking Indianapolis and Illinois for Dick as well, as far as what we were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And usually a guy gets the book, he gets the belt right away.
Yep.
But I sat back. I said, what's best for this promotion? My specialty was tag team wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
My first tag team partner was Golden Boy Paul Christie, and we drew tremendous money over when it was just WWA, just Indiana, Illinois.
Right.
But then Christie and me had a party of the ways. I'm still a great friend of mine. I love the man. Then Bulldog Don Kent and I came along, and that was an even stronger team.
Right.
And so I concentrated my efforts to tag team wrestling. And besides, who's a better champion if you're going to have Dick the Bruiser than Wojo?
Right, that's true.
I mean, when you look at Wojo, you look at a 5'11", 285-pound guy with an inch of fat on him coming to the ring that you know can kick anybody's butt in the world.
That's right.
And that's why I used to take challenges from the audience. That's why we put up $1 million for a match to shoot, either Hogan or Flair,
uh-huh.
both the same night if they wanted. We wanted Wojo to be a real champion that people could look to. And anybody that wanted to come down, they had to bring a doctor's clearance slip and stuff.
Yeah.
There's some certain stipulations. We had $10,000 for anybody that could beat Wojo.
Yeah.
And nobody ever did.
Yeah.
But that's what I thought was best for us. Then Scott Steiner came.
Yeah.
Now, believe me, you can hurt my feelings if you want to. Who would you think would make a stronger champion, me or Scott Steiner as a single?
Well, in retrospect, yeah, I'd have Scott, given where he went.
But I trained him. Where he went is where I sent him. And I say that in a good way. I mean, I sent him along, I taught him how to wrestle. professionally. He was a top-notch amateur before he ever met me, but I taught him how to wrestle professionally. I booked him his first 100 matches anyway. His first 100 matches, he's working for me. His real name was Scott Recksteiner, but they changed his name to Steiner. But my point is, I always looked what was good for the promotion. I never thought that I would be a strong singles champion. And as such, that's why I never pursued it. I stayed with him. I thought that kept me, and once again, I get some friction on this because we didn't have the bleach blonde hair and we didn't have the. I don't think there was too many tag teams more cohesive than Kent and I.
Yep, I agree.
We really had it together. We knew what each other was thinking at all times. We knew what we were doing, and we drew money, of course.
Yep.
And the fact that we were 5-time champions, I mean, we lost it 4 times, so that means I wasn't one of these megalomaniac bookers that couldn't be beaten.
Yep.
And I tried to do it always what was best for the promotion. And I know what I wanted to say a minute ago, and I forgot to say it when I lost my train of thought for a minute. Because I was talking about my book, Confessions of a Big Time Wrestler. We're talking about things on the internet that weren't true. Another thing I come across on the internet is, oh, sure, Jerry Graham wrote a book about himself, putting himself over, and what a, you know, arrogant, egotistical, all these other wrestlers wrote books about themselves. But this book, whether you want to get it or not, fans, Dave's advertised it on his site, so we don't need to get into that. This book is about the interesting people that I have met while I was in the wrestling business. It was not about me. It was about me meeting Bull Cleary and experiences with Dick the Bruiser, experiences with the Sheik, experiences with Hulk Hogan, experiences with Scott Steiner. It was a story of the people I met. It was meant to be like a history, something to be put down, stories. And I divide this book into 3 sections. Stories that are absolutely fact because I've seen them myself. Okay, like when the Sheik and Ivan Koloff got in a horrible fist fight in an airplane. We were going to the Middle East, to Kuwait. They were bleeding. I mean, it was a fight. They got drunk and they got a horrible fight, Iron Sheik and Ivan Koloff. That was a true story. Then there was what I called credible stories. I believe the witness, like Flying Fred Curry, told me a story about Jerry Graham getting thrown out of a fancy nightclub in New York. I believe that because I figured Fred Curry was a credible source. And my third category was urban legends. I don't know if this story is true or not, but this is what I've been saying for years. I make it very clear in this book what I tell you. Is it a fact as I know it, a story that I believe the source, or an urban legend? And but the book was not made to get me over or to make me some kind of a superstar because I don't care about that. I just wanted to leave something behind for the business. So I think it's a good book for 4 hours of audio and a 90-minute tape, not tape, but disc with matches. 90 minutes of matches you can watch on TV and 4 hours of me talking about wrestling and the people that I met. I mean, like I said, a little bit about me, but that's not the theme of the book. That's what I wanted to say about internet not being always truthful. I thought there was a law that said what's on the internet, it has to be true. Isn't that right?
That's right.
That's not right?
I don't know.
I'm going to get you a copy. I promised you a copy of that book. I haven't forgotten.
All right.
I'm going to get you a copy.
Sounds good.
So I think you'll enjoy it. Yep. It's just whatever. Done. So anyway, anything else about Bruiser and Bedlam you had in mind? I'm a little bit off track there.
Yeah, I actually got a couple more here. Just do you remember the final WWA show that ran before you guys decided to close shop?
Well, the final one in Toledo that I was involved with was the Leon Spinks Wojo match.
Okay.
And but I wrestled a few shows in Indiana afterwards. Dick kept a few of the towns open. And the last show I remember wrestling for Dick was in South Bend, Indiana. And that night was a story in itself. Dick the Bruiser had an appendicitis in the ring, wrestling Wojo. He never stopped the match. The match was over. Went back, took a shower, got his clothes on, paid all the wrestlers, and drove home to Indianapolis to check himself into the hospital.
Oh, man.
that was absolutely a tough man.
Now,
Dick the Bruiser was absolutely.
How close was that to his passing? Because I heard they were at spot shows almost up to his passing.
Well, another thing I want to say is I was the last person to ever wrestle Dick the Bruiser on television. Okay, that's something. His passing, the appendicitis had nothing to do with his passing because he died from an aorta of the esophagus, I believe.
Yeah.
And aorta is a part of the heart. When a vein blows up, I can't think of the name of it now. But while he was working out in Florida, he had a aneurysm, they call it, an aneurysm of the esophagus.
Yeah.
And he drowned in his own blood before he could. Now, I asked doctors, what is an aneurysm? Because you're born with them. I hope that makes you comfortable, Dave. You're born with them, and it's a weak spot of the vein, and it can stay dormant forever till you die of something else. It can pop when you're 5 years old. It can pop when you're 8 years old.
Yeah.
But as the doctor explained it to me, you're born with a tendency to aneurysm in some of your veins. And I mean, what happens is when it kicks in, it's what it blows up like a balloon. Now, Wojo had the aneurysm of the aorta. That's what killed John Ritter, the TV movie star.
Right.
John Ritter, same thing. But Wojo was able to survive. He had one at 48. Now Wojo was 68 and doing good.
Yeah.
But usually aneurysms can be serious. My grandfather, of blessed memory, died of an aneurysm of the heart. I'm not sure which part of the heart. But in those days, there was no treatment at all for them. Today, they can save some people. Wojo was one of them.
Yeah.
But I don't think that the appendicitis had anything to do with his passing, in my opinion, but I'm not a doctor.
Yeah.
I am a doctor, but not of medicine. I'm a doctor of thinkology.
Yeah. So what became of the WWE name after Bruiser passes? Where does that...
Oh, please. You've got to... It's on my Facebook wall. We started up the WWA here in Toledo. We had a local TV channel, and so the guys wanted to get started, so my brother ran a hall. I says, you can have the hall on Sundays for free.
Okay.
And he gave us the concession, and so we started running again. And also, we get legal papers that we can't use the name WWA because some guy named Albert Patterson.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That's where I was going.
So I found him on the internet, so I put him on, sarcastic. It says, this is why the wrestling business is so tough. We got two-fisted executives like this. Is this the next Vince McMahon, the next Donaldson? Did you see that on my page?
I saw that, yep.
This guy, I mean, I was shocked. I mean, what? This, by the way, Vince McMahon took him to court and cleaned his clock. My lawyer told me we could have done the same thing, but we didn't have the money to do it. We just changed our name. It was easier.
Yeah.
But what does this guy think he is? I mean,
I don't know.
You got to buy up. You got to buy up these trademarks, and then you got to charge people for it.
Yeah.
Then, the way he's talking, you could think he gave me the impression that he could read and write. But I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of aiming at when I asked that question because I had heard about him before I saw your post. And I wondered what all that was.
Well, I posted that before, right after it happened. The business is a magnet, draws strange people.
Sure does.
I know Jimmy Cornette, who I respect a lot. Anybody that imitates me, I got to respect, because he told me himself that he used to watch me on television.
Yeah.
Of course, there's only one me, but Jimmy Cornette, very successful, very smart man. I saw an interview with him the other day. Well, he said something that I agree with entirely. He says, everybody in wrestling is crazy. He says, either you're sane when you get in and the business drives you crazy, or you're crazy to get in the first place. But there's nobody participating in the business that isn't crazy. But some crazy people can be smart, and some people can be dumb. And we talk about the WWA situation, we talk about a dumb, crazy person instead of a smart, crazy person.
That's right. Doctor, you got any final words before we go?
No, just I really enjoy doing this show with you because it brings back memories. I like to talk about the old days. I really think I'm a walking encyclopedia.
Available on all streaming platforms, it's professional wrestling's greatest, largest, privately owned wrestling library. All the classic hits, flips, slams, and pins of yesteryear are on one place. It's Ultimate Classic Wrestling. Check out the Nature Boy Ric Flair, Hulk Hogan, Mr. USA Tony Atlas, Tito Santana, Rick Martel, a who's who of professional wrestling's greatest spotlight stars ever to grace the squared circle all in one place. Grab the best seat in the house for memories and mayhem on Ultimate Classic Wrestling.
Hey guys, Ray Russell here. Lots of new stuff happening here at WrestleCopia. If you haven't checked out our website at WrestleCopia.com, it's a great way to keep up with the latest episodes of all of your favorite Copia programming, from the Wrestling Memory Grenade to Regional Wrestling with the Territory Talk, the Wrestling Stoop with the legendary Bob Roop, and of course all of those programs also available at your favorite podcast streaming platforms. And if you want to stay up to date with everything going on in the Copia world, all the latest news, random thoughts, fun videos, pictures, and more, make sure to join the more than 33,000 followers over at facebook.com/wrestlinggrenade. Don't be left out. And last, but definitely not least, it's what keeps the entire machine going. I'm talking about patreon.com/wrestlecopia. We appreciate your support in helping us pay the bills to keep the WrestleCopia Podcast Network running and enabling us to continue to bring you all the quality programming that we offer.
Okay, guys, and thank you to Phil Monahan both for writing the book, Blood and Bedlam in the Glass City, and for coming on the show today to discuss it. Of course, always a thank you to the friend of the show, Dr. Jerry Graham Jr., for all the insight and stories and everything else that he has shared with me. I consider him a very good friend. He and I message and text and talk. I've interviewed him numerous times, and I am always, always very appreciative of his time and his wisdom. Guys, follow me on social media. I'm pretty much on any platform. Just look up Nostalgic Dave Dynasty or The Dave Dynasty, and you can find me. Also, be sure to subscribe to me on YouTube for lots of classic wrestling content, plus all my various podcasts, and plus some YouTube exclusives, such as the unboxing videos that I mentioned earlier. Go check out all the other WrestleCopia Network podcasts. You can find the individual podcasts on your favorite podcast platform, or you can visit WrestleCopia.com. Also, be sure to check out my friends at the Ultimate Classic Wrestling Library. Visit ClassicWrestling.net to sign up for your account, and then download the Ultimate Classic Wrestling app on all of your smart devices. Now, next episode is going to be a cool one. My guest is scheduled to be former member of Raven's Flock, Sick Boy. We're going to discuss everything about Raven, the Flock, WCW, and much more. So be sure to come back next episode. This era of WCW, it's fun to talk about, but it's not one that I don't dive into it a lot, right? I don't talk to very many guys from this era or anything else. So this is going to be a really cool chance for me to talk about a time period that maybe I don't talk about a lot. And everybody knows I'm a fan of Raven, so I did always enjoy the Flock and everything else. So I'm very much looking forward to talking to Sick Boy and getting his perspective, his stories, his memories of this time and of the Flock. So guys, make sure you come back next episode. Subscribe so you don't miss it. You can set it to auto download. Bam, it'll be there when it's released. So thank you for supporting the show, guys. And wherever you go and whatever you do, be good, be safe, and always keep on growing.
Fans, we brought you All-Star Championship Wrestling. This is Sam Manager thanking you for being with us and saying until next time, so long, everyone.
Wrestling Nostalgia is copyright Dave Dynasty. Bruiser voice done by John Lawson.